ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, Selena Green here with you today. It feels like there is far too much going on to fit into the 55 minutes I get with you today, but let's see how we go. You're going to get an update shortly on a meeting of those in the beekeeping and pollination industries now that we've got varroa mite confirmed at multiple locations in South Australia, and find out why you'll be waiting longer to know about the future use of paraquat and diquat. Don't forget, you can use my talkback number. It's 1300 160222 to get in touch throughout the program, or text me on 0467 922 783. But let's start with some good news first up today, and that's overnight. We've heard from a few oyster growers that the Franklin Harbour harvesting area is now back open. That's months after being closed due to brevetoxin in the waters. Megan Turner has a family oyster growing business at Franklin Harbour. Megan, good afternoon. Welcome to the Country Hour.
Oh, thanks, Selena. And we're really excited to be talking to you today because we have started selling our oysters again today, which is great. And Franklin Harbour was officially opened at about 3:45 yesterday.
That is so brilliant. How long has it been since you've been able to do this?
Yeah, well, not that we've been counting, but it's been 121 days.
Thereabouts or exact, I think. Yeah. Oh.
So, over 4 months, which has certainly been a challenging 4 months. And the not knowing was probably the hardest part. I think if we knew we had a set 4 months, a lot of growers here would have been quite comfortable with that and being able to plan. It's definitely the hardest thing, you know, not knowing how long we're in this for. And we're very fortunate the algae seems to be dissipating quickly. There's good signs in the harbour at the moment. The water's looking really good. And the oysters looking fabulous, which for a while there they were looking a little bit grey around the gills and we were getting some mortalities out there. They didn't actually appreciate the diet they are on of harmful algae, but our levels have certainly dropped right out. You know, some areas are zero cells. So there's only one deep water site that's showing just over 2,000 cells a litre, which is quite negligible, the lowest we've seen in that site for a while.
And this is timely because, you know, Christmas is just around the corner, and were you sort of really hoping, fingers and toes crossed, that you'd get things back up and running before Christmas?
Absolutely. We are very fortunate to have this 3-week selling window before Christmas. It's our busiest time of the year in the lead up to Christmas, where a lot of our processors are wanting to get oysters in the system for that Christmas New Year period. We're not quite in a situation where we're ready to push out huge amounts just yet. This is the first. So we've had a couple of results under the food safety cutoff over the last couple of weeks, and all the signs are pointing to that the levels will continue to decline. But as growers, we need to get a little bit of confidence under our belts again. So we're just starting to sell some oysters out today and next week. And once we've got a little bit more confidence around the levels, we'll ramp it right up coming into Christmas time.
Take me back to yesterday with the news. So obviously there'd been some promising signs. So was it a complete surprise when you got the call yesterday to say, yep, go time?
We were working towards it. It wasn't a surprise because the previous week's result was under the cutoff, and we'd been seeing a lot of promising signs in our harbour. And, you know, talking to Simon, my husband, he's been farming for 35 years, he's got a very intimate relationship with how the water and the oysters are looking, as do a lot of the growers here in Franklin Harbour that have been in this game for a long, long time, that they were seeing all the positive signs and that they were getting some confidence that, you know, we would be able to to sell. So we were half expecting it. We'd already had a phone call with some staff at PIRZA Food Safety. So we'd kind of, they actually hadn't told us that we were open, but we were starting to get the feeling like we might be getting closer. And I certainly want to acknowledge the staff at SASQAP, who's our regulator, and PIRZA Food Safety, who've been, you know, going through an intense time as well. And they will continue to be busy as they keep monitoring our oysters and our water quality weekly. But they've certainly been, very considerate. They released our results a little bit earlier. There's still some zones that have got pending results yesterday afternoon, and we're really grateful that they released our results knowing that we were safe to sell, because it's allowed us that opportunity to call our buyers and get some oysters out the door.
Yeah, so you straight in there harvesting once you were given that, you know, official it's open, go for it.
Yes. So, yeah, we were lining up ready to go. I don't know that our staff were particularly happy when they were told at 4 p.m. yesterday, which I think we're gearing up to knock off. We said, no, we're going out in the water, we're harvesting. So, and the reason for that is, one, we're a little bit excited, but two, we've certainly got some space pressures on our oyster lease. Because we haven't sold for a few months, a lot of growers here are getting very full out on their oyster leases, and the pressure has been to either, one, sell oysters if we can, or if we couldn't, to move them. Because, yeah, once you get a lot of oysters in an area, they start to compete for food and they can decondition. So it was very timely. I think we were just about at our limit.
Speaking to Megan Turner on the Country Hour today, she's an oyster grower at Franklin Harbour, and got the news late yesterday that they had been given the all clear after 4 months of closure due to the algal bloom, that they can now start harvesting and selling their oysters again. You know, we obviously don't want to dwell too much on how hard the past 4 months have been, and I know a lot has been said about, you know, that incredibly tough situation, and now you've not even had quite 24 hours of now being back open. So sort of how you're feeling about things, Megan, about sort of what you've been through and where to from here?
Yeah, well, we've got a lot of confidence that we can hopefully stay open until the Christmas period. You know, as I said, all the signs are there. And, yeah, I guess it's a huge feeling of relief yesterday afternoon. I just want to acknowledge, you know, all the growers in Franklin Harbour and people in the wider community as well, Selena. Like, there has been associated businesses that, you know, depend on oysters to be sold, depend on the quality of the water in Franklin Harbour, whether it be freight companies or our suppliers or... Yeah, even just the local businesses in town have been feeling it. There's been definitely a lot of financial and emotional strain, and everyone's been absolute champions throughout this time. I would say there's definitely a lot of gentlemen within our industry here who have been just the quiet achievers and just putting one foot in front of the other. So, yeah, a big pat on everyone's backs. The people have been going out. We've got staff that have been going out and getting locally through oyster business, oyster samples and water samples every week. And, yeah, they will continue to do that. But certainly, I think it's a big relief for everyone. Mm. I think we may start to smile. You may start to see some smiles, Selena, around the traps, which would be nice.
Fantastic. Well, let's support the industry and get more smiles out there and get people, you know, buying South Australian oysters, and hopefully a lot of the other oyster growing areas will follow suit, and this is a sign of things to come, fingers crossed.
Absolutely. So, you know, that's right, fingers crossed. And, yes, we are here in Franklin Harbour, we're about 15% of the industry. As you know, the whole West Coast is still open for sale. Unfortunately, our mates on the York Peninsula are still closed, and we hope that their levels, that's showing good signs of coming down as well. So we hope that they're open in the not-too-distant future.
Well, fantastic. Megan, I know you've got a busy day. You've got some oysters to get out there and a lot of catching up to do, so we'll let you go. But thanks so much for joining us on the Country Hour today.
Thank you, Selena. We're very excited and we're very grateful for all the support we've had. And thanks for checking in today and look forward to speaking to you again.
That is Franklin Harbour oyster grower Megan Turner there. And I have reached out to Perza for some more details on this reopening and if there's any update for the remaining oyster growing areas that do remain closed, and they're going to get back to me. So once I have that response, I'll bring it to you. It's 15 minutes past 12 right now. You're with Selena Green on the Country Hour. Well, South Australia's Varroa Industry Advisory Committee, SAVIAC, met yesterday following the news that we've now had multiple confirmed outbreaks of varroa mite in the state. In the past week, we've had outbreaks confirmed so far in the Limestone Coast, near Salt Creek and Taratap, and Selleck's Hill in the Upper Fluorio. Well, Simon Gerblick represents the Beekeeper Society of South Australia on SAVIAC. He spoke to me earlier about what was discussed.
The information that has come out that there's been detections down at Selleck's, at Salt Creek and at Taratap, they're just the recent ones, and all of those, the commercial beekeepers involved in those were up at Gummaraka previously. So they haven't found any varroa up at Gummaraka yet, but they're looking, and it could be there because they've come from there. And it's really concentrating on how we get communications out to try to get South Australian beekeepers to get up to date with what's happening, because it's hitting us a lot quicker than we thought. Because last week, all that we had was near border town, varroa in Victoria near us. So it's really, PIRZA has just updated the website, and if you go into the PIRZA website and look for varroa, you can see the map now. And we really need all South Australian beekeepers to virtually assume that varroa could be near them and to start doing varroa tests. So if you haven't been doing the where you get the 300 bees and you drown them in alcohol and look for the number of varroa, so start doing that, or at a bare minimum, looking at the drone bees, which is where you can find varroa. So just at least uncapping your drone brood and looking for varroa there, because we need people to start checking, because varroa could already be around Gummaraka and spreading in Selleck's and Salt Creek and Taratap. Mm. And I guess there will continue to be updates coming out via the PIRZA email. So as more people are checking and finding varroa, there will be more spots put on the map. So we just really need all beekeepers, if you're unregistered, you should register so that PIRZA knows where your location is, and so that you start getting these the emails that come out direct from PIRZA letting you know of the latest places where varroa has been found.
As we have been talking for some time about the potential for it to come in here and people being prepared and doing the tests, there seems a real sense of urgency now that this needs to be happening. It needs to be happening within the recreational beekeeping community a lot more than it has been for now, that you know, there is that great potential for it to be in more places than we know so far.
Yeah, I guess it's the recreational and commercial as well, I guess, because it's a mindset thing. Until it's here, you're thinking it's not here, it's not real, it's not real. And New South Wales has been through it the last 3 years. Queensland has just, and Victoria have been going through it, and it is really distressing when you don't check, and when you first open up your hive and your hive is dying off because it's just covered and drowning in varroa. It's like it's almost too late then, and then we're going to lose so many beehives. And so the earlier that you can detect it, the earlier you can start treating it. And so, yeah, the warnings are, they've found a varroa on a hive at Selleck's now. They've found one at Salt Creek. And each day that there could be more alerts coming out. So this weekend would be really good for everyone to go through and check, because it could actually be here already.
And as you say, register, that is something that you're encouraging beekeepers to do if they haven't already. And I guess that's a hard question to answer then, how many beekeepers there might be out there who haven't registered as yet?
Well, the figures that I know, there's about 3,500 registered beekeepers, and I think there's almost an estimate that there could be another 3,000 unregistered. Most of the unregistered are probably recreational people who have just got one, two, three hives or something. You think, oh, well, I don't need to, or maybe that they misunderstand it, that you can have four hives and register for free, and they think, oh, well, I don't need to register. But if you don't register, you don't get any of these PRSA updates. And so I haven't ever heard of anyone, you know, so even if you haven't been registered for 10 years, and you've had two beehives, just register. It's very unlikely, I think, that that there's going to be any looking backwards at historical stuff. Just register now, then you'll start getting the updates as soon as they come out.
Simon Gerblick there, who represents the Beekeepers Society of South Australia on SAVIAC. That's South Australia's Varroa Industry Advisory Committee. 20 minutes past 12. Now, as I was speaking about the oyster situation at Franklin Harbour, I did just get a response from PRSA to my query, and I've got this statement from a PRSA spokesperson, which says the Franklin Harbour harvesting area reopened yesterday afternoon after the latest testing by the South Australian Shellfish Quality Assurance Program confirmed brevetoxin levels are below both the regulatory and precautionary limit. A harvest area is closed until the brevetoxin level falls below the required food safety levels for two consecutive weeks and the Karenia count is decreasing. Other currently closed zones will be reopened as soon as these conditions are met. That statement from a PRSA spokesperson.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, the Australian Pesticides and Regulatory Medicines Authority, the APVMA, has again delayed its decision on the future of paraquat and diquat. A final regulatory decision on the commonly used farm chemicals had already been pushed to the end of this year. Now it's not expected until mid-2026. In announcing the delay, the APVMA says it needs time to take into account updated research out of the United States. Andrew Wiedemann is the Southern Director of Grain Producers Australia. Joins me. Afternoon, Andrew, and thanks for coming on the Country Hour.
Yeah, look, thanks, Selena, and good afternoon, listeners.
The APVMA, they've pushed off again this decision, final decision around the use of paraquat and diquat. So this is now, there's been multiple times where this decision has been pushed back now?
Yeah, look, that's right, Selena, and I suppose that it can be seen as quite frustrating as people want a bit of surety or to understand really what's going on. There was a number of submissions obviously put in after the original draft decision by the regulator in regards to the efficacious rates they put out. There's obviously been a number of submissions, and including obviously the Grain Producers Australia. We've been working quite closely obviously with the regulator and on this issue. And yeah, we've now had another further pushback, but I think for a very clear reason. It's just to make sure that the new information that's coming out of America from the EPA has the proper assessments in combination with the current review, because there's nothing worse than putting out an assessment and then having to turn around and potentially even do it again. So, we've had a chat with the APVMA about it. You know, I'm pretty comfortable that, you know, the decision that will be made on the right grounds, hopefully. So we just need to just wait, I suppose, Selena, and get on with farming.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how across you are around the EPA's research there in the US around this, but you do think it is likely to make a big shift in thinking around the use of these chemicals than what already has been looked at?
Well, what it does, it puts in a new calculation into the formula. That's what's been proposed here, and so that calculation will need to be rerun. So essentially, right across all of the different modelling that's already been done, Selena, and that's why it's going to take the extra time. So, and I think that unfortunately, yeah, it's a time factor, but it's a time factor that means that this work should be done, because there'll be questions raised if it wasn't.
What does it mean?
Part of the assessment.
What does it mean for growers, I guess, to know that they now have at least another several months before a decision is made? Does that level of uncertainty, does it buy a bit more time and a bit more capacity to look at some alternatives to those chemicals?
I think, you know, Australia's got to be seen as a ground for innovation still, Selena, and I do have concerns around the timeliness, for sure, in terms of some of the permits and new registrations that go through the APVMA, but I feel confident under the current leadership that in time, I think that will definitely improve as they build new capacity within the organisation. So, yeah, look, aside of chemistries, it's about having a team that can actually assess these in a timely manner and look at ways that we can potentially improve the timeliness of these new products going through the regulatory system, you know, whether AI can be used eventually and these sort of things as well to give an initial assessment. That's something that we've proposed as maybe an option. But in overall, it still comes down to the regulatory team assessing all of the peer-reviewed work that goes into formulating the decisions around new chemistries or existing chemistries being able to be continued to use. And I think that one of the factors, and I don't mind raising it here, Selena, is that it is quite frustrating for us in a regulatory sense, is that we don't have an assessment around what happens if a product's taken out of the environment. What does that mean as an impact on the industry when that happens? So I think that that's something that we need to look at in terms of a legislation change. Currently, that's not able to be assessed by the regulator, but I think in time it should be.
Well, now we wait and see that little bit longer to see what the APVMA will come back with. But, Andrew, thanks for joining us with your thoughts on the Country Hour today.
Thanks, Selena, and let's hope for a good, clean harvest of good weather. Thank you.
So certainly do that. And speaking of weather, we'll cross there next. That was Andrew Wiedemann, Southern Director of Grain Producers Australia. Now, in a statement, the APVMA says its final regulatory decision on paraquat and diquat has been deferred following this release of the US Environmental Protection Agency's updated review of a recent study. According to the APVMA, the review released this month presents US EPA's conclusion that there is greater uncertainty regarding the potential for paraquat to volatilize than previously considered. The statement says the APVMA is reviewing its assessment of the volatility of paraquat and ensuring we have appropriately taken into account any concerns raised in the updated review from the US. This additional time will allow consideration of the updated review and, if necessary, refinements to the APVMA's risk assessments. 26 minutes past 12, you're with Selena Green. Let's head to the Weather Bureau, and our senior forecaster today is Simon Timke. Hi, Simon.
Hi there, Selena.
And it looks like we've got some interesting weather developing in the west.
Yes, we certainly have. The situation today is we've got a fairly broad low pressure trough moving across from the west, just moving across Western Eyre Peninsula now. There's a pretty significant band of middle and high level cloud to the east of that trough, and we have seen quite a bit of shower and thunderstorm activity out of that band. And we're just starting to see some thunderstorms and showers develop to the west of that main band now. And we do have a severe thunderstorm warning that has recently been issued for the West Coast District, just to the west of Woodner or thereabouts. And that severe thunderstorm warning is for large hail and damaging winds. So if you are over that area, do take a bit of extra care. And I think we'll probably see that warning area expand or some further warning areas develop during the afternoon. I think thunderstorms are possible over most districts today. And I think an area, if you can imagine a line roughly sort of going east-west through about Clare or Port Wakefield even, north of that line, there is a risk of severe thunderstorms with similar sort of conditions to that one that I've just described, with large hail, damaging winds, possibly some heavy rainfall as well out of some of those storms. The trough itself will continue to move eastwards. It will clear to the east of the state very late tonight or early tomorrow morning, and will take most of that weather with it. But the risky time today is through the afternoon and the evening, particularly the early evening. So if you are out and about, do keep an eye out for those severe thunderstorm warnings and take a bit of extra care. The showers and thunderstorms associated with that feature should clear away to the east pretty quickly on Saturday morning. So the eastern districts might still be a chance of a shower or thunderstorm with that, but that will clear fairly early tomorrow morning. For the rest of Saturday, we see a high pressure ridge move in from the west, so we'll still see some isolated showers about the agricultural area, but they'll contract to the southern agricultural area by afternoon and continue on and off during the rest of the day over that area. Similar sort of day on Sunday to Saturday. We stay in that southwesterly airstream in the south of the state. So again, some isolated showers about the agricultural area, contracting to the southern agricultural area during the afternoon. And then on Monday, the main high centre moves over the Bight and extends a ridge over the west of our state. But there's just a little cold front that sneaks over the southeast part of the state. and that will keep the showers going. So we'll still see showers over the agricultural area, but they'll contract pretty quickly back to the southern coast and ranges during the afternoon, and then through the sort of the middle part of next week, Tuesday and Wednesday, we'll probably have mostly dry conditions, I think, and conditions will start to warm up a little bit too as the high eventually moves to the east and we see the winds turn around a little bit more northerly. So rainfall totals for that that period out to the end of Tuesday, the far southwest should be mostly dry, but today, and most of the rainfall will be today, widespread areas of 5 to 15 millimetres. We'll see some local falls of 15 to 30 millimetres. And maybe with some of the thunderstorms, we might see some falls even a little bit more than that, maybe reaching the 30 to 50 millimetre range, I think, Selena.
All right. Thanks, Simon. And yeah, take care out there, everyone listening who's in those areas where those warnings are. Simon Timke, our senior forecaster today at the Weather Bureau. It's 12:30.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
I forgot to mention the Upper Western weather for tomorrow. Partly cloudy in the Upper Western districts of New South Wales. Slight chance of a shower in the morning. Chance of a thunderstorm in the morning and afternoon. And we've got overnight temperatures falling between 17 and 24. Daytime temperatures between 29 and 36. For the Lower Western, a medium chance of showers in the early morning. Chance of a thunderstorm in the early morning with a sunny afternoon. Overnight between 13 and 17. During the day in the mid to high 20s. Yes, Selena Green with you, bringing you the Country Hour on this Friday. Coming up, some renewed warnings for anyone travelling to Kangaroo Island, where they're desperate to keep varroa mite off the island. And also, a landline crew headed to Cooper Creek recently to check out the new barge, and they've got a great story coming up this weekend, so we'll give you a little sneak peek of that as well. That's all coming up after we get news headlines from Matt Coleman. Good afternoon.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, a University of South Australia study will investigate where treatment and support options fall short for patients with Parkinson's disease living in regional SA. Study lead Sue Sharrod says about 10,000 people in the state have been diagnosed with Parkinson's, which currently has no cure. The research is seeking people with the disease living in regional areas to tell their stories. A Flinders University project has begun drilling at the Coorong to install monitoring and to measure the impact of rising sea levels and storm surges. Probes will be placed in the holes to measure water levels and salinity and could potentially collect data for the next 30 years. And elite Australian cyclist Ben O'Connor has been confirmed for next year's Tour Down Under in January. The TDU says the 30-year-old rider will lead Australia's team Jayco Alula from the UCI World Tour season start in South Australia. O'Connor has previously won four stages across all three Grand Tours, two of which were at the Tour de France. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, yeah, Kangaroo Island's beekeepers are asking travellers to swing by a car wash before hopping on board the ferry as the industry tries to stop the spread of varroa mite. As we've been covering, the deadly bee parasite was this week detected at two new locations on the Upper Fluorio Peninsula and the Limestone Coast thus far. Well, Sharon Simons, who works on the island at Clifford's Honey Farm and serves as secretary for the Kangaroo Island Beekeepers Association, says she's hopeful the island can remain varroa free.
When people are travelling, the thing that they would do accidentally is that they could have bees on their car or stuck in the grill of their car, and if the bee has varroa, the little parasite varroa can be on the bee and you don't realise. We would like people to clean their cars before they come to the island in case they accidentally bring bees, and also all the normal biosecurity that you can't bring bees or beekeeping equipment or honey or anything like that to the island, because that can bring other diseases as well. Even though you're not going to where there's beehives, bees can be flying around and you're not sure whether you've got stuff on your car. And even if you're just checking your car, you'll be finding out if there's anything there and you can clean it better. People that are on holidays coming to the island and people that live on the island are going to be travelling through where varroa is. And as we find out more, when the people are doing more testing, there'll be more varroa found in South Australia. So yeah, Kangaroo Island's the last place you can find Ligurian bees in the world, and they're the world's oldest bee sanctuary on this island, and we've been trying to keep the bees healthy since they were brought here in 1885, so we're trying to protect them. And yeah, this is the biggest threat to the bees that we've had.
What impact would varroa have if it did reach the island and your farm particularly?
Well, varroa does wipe out bees by weakening them, and then also spreading other diseases that can kill the bees. So the population of bees on the island, it would wipe out a lot of the bees that are here and make it very hard to continue beekeeping. It would be a big threat to the bees that we have on the island.
Is there any kind of management you are or can do on the ground, or is it really just a matter of just asking and hoping everyone does the right thing in terms of biosecurity?
So we do have biosecurity officers at Cape Jervis where you catch the ferry. So they're asking everyone that's coming to the island if they're bringing anything in their cars. And there's also sentinel hives that are set up so that if there is any varroa, they'll be finding it in the sentinel hives. So there's one of those at Cape Jervis. And there's also sentinel hives on the island. So hopefully it doesn't happen. But if it does, we've got early detection.
Sharon Simons there from Clifford's Honey Farm, speaking with Isabella Kelly. Alperza has already boosted its biosecurity measures for the island in response to the first mite being found in South Australia some weeks ago, but it does admit it will be difficult to keep varroa off the island. Head of Biosecurity Georgie Cornish says the focus is on education, but she stops short of saying whether more measures like car washes would be brought in.
We have now got increased biosecurity officers so that we're covering 100% of those ferry rides. So any travellers who are jumping on a ferry, you will see that we have biosecurity officers there undertaking checks to make sure that people are, you know, understanding what those risks are and to do some of those checks for that. We've also implemented and put in place 9 sentinel hives, and that's about making sure that we're maintaining and monitoring bee health on the island. So that's both at Cape Jervis before, obviously, anything can get to the island, and also on the island as well. So 9 different sites that we'll continue to manage to make sure we're monitoring where bees' health and how that's tracking.
Would vehicle washdowns, either voluntary or if they did become, I know you're not looking at it, but if they were a part of the ferry transport process, would they realistically make a difference to any bee incursions onto the island?
So for us, the reason we often talk about washdowns across the landscape more broadly is for a range of things. So obviously KI being an island is really unique. It's it has lots of things that we seek to protect and not take on there, and that includes weeds and all of those sorts of things as well. So often the washdown is really around making sure that soil isn't on the vehicle, because that can bring with it seeds. So it's really around reducing some of those things as well.
As varroa mite has started to spread across the state, do you believe that it's possible to keep the mite out of Kangaroo Island?
I think we've always said that what we want to do is work hard and work with the beekeepers to give everyone the maximum amount of time to be prepared, to build resilience, to have plans around varroa mite. We've seen that varroa mite exists in other jurisdictions. We know that that is a challenge, and we want to work with the beekeepers to make sure that people have that resilience. That's precisely what we're seeking to do with Kangaroo Island beekeepers.
Do you think it's possible to keep it out, though?
I think for us, we're really conscious that we've seen how it looks in the eastern states, and we've seen the challenges that are faced there. We'll continue to work through those, and we'll continue to see how much support and where we can support our beekeepers here in South Australia to try and manage that.
As PIRRS's Georgie Cornish speaking with Bridget Herman. It is 22 minutes to one coming up. We'll take a look at the wine industry as the wine glut continues globally and growers continue to struggle with prices.
I'm afraid it's got to be said that if your prices weren't good in 25, they're probably not going to be any better in 26 or even 27, 28.
That's coming up next.
On Landline this week, launching a new paddle steamer on the Murray River.
Put a fire in this thing, starts popping and crackling and steam whistles, and that's the whole evocative thing of a steamboat.
That's Landline, Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years in 2025.
Hi, I'm Jackson from Lamoureux. Happy 80th birthday to The Country Hour.
Next Wednesday, that's the big day. We've got lots of stuff planned for you next week. Very exciting. You're with Selena Green. Well, there's been a lot of focus on the glut of red wine globally, but now an oversupply of white wine grapes is placing even more pressure on growers already in crisis. Riverland Wine says prices for Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc have declined dramatically for the upcoming vintage. Growers have previously been battling an oversupply of red wine grapes and were encouraged to switch their varieties. Third-generation Renmark grower Amanda Dima says the family switched to Chardonnay to adapt to the market, but now they're facing the same problems. She's one of a number of Riverland growers who've signed a letter to the state premier calling for urgent support.
So we've had below cost of production prices for so many years. We don't have any more capital left to use to diversify crops, change plantings, and even if we are, whites have just taken a turn for the worse as well.
Yeah, can you tell us a bit about the whites? Do you know what the indicative pricing is for next year on white varieties?
We're not completely sure on what those prices are for the white varieties, but they are barely going to cover cost of production.
And how does that sit with you, considering, you know, for years we have been hearing diversify to whites, try different things?
Yeah, I think, you know, most of us have tried to diversify to some extent. We've removed all of our Shiraz and planted Chardonnay, so it's another kick in the guts when you've spent that hard-earned money to reinvest and it's not got us anywhere.
When did the industry kind of realise that it was heading that way for whites?
I don't think there's a real sticking point in when things have turned. It's a global issue and most of the other countries are having some government intervention and some support to make, you know, informed decisions, change what you're growing. We've had no leadership from government. So we're calling on the government now to help us put in a crisis meeting and work with us, work with the banks. All of our growers are at breaking point and we're seeing that more and more often with outbursts, and we want government to step in before it's too late, before it claims one of our farmers.
As part of that, you've penned a letter to the Premier calling for some urgent action. An urgent crisis meeting is one of those things, but what else are you calling for?
We're calling for support for the industry to rebalance. So we have growers that, you know, they've been worked on this land for decades. They need some support to exit sustainably. We don't need drippers, posts, wires, vines that are dying and creating biosecurity threats for neighbouring properties. We want some support in how is this going to be done with least impact on the community, the region and our land.
That's Renmark wine grape grower Amanda Dimas there speaking with Anita Ward. The government says it's actively considering the Riverland Wines calls for an industry meeting by the end of January. You can read more on this story. There's lots more to it. It's on the ABC Rural website, abc.net.au/rural. But what are the numbers saying about wine supply and demand? And is that spreading across both red and white wines? Globally, harvest in 2024 was another record low. So supply is coming down, but unfortunately so is consumption. In fact, consumption is still lower than global supply by around 1 billion litres. Yes, that's billion with a B. Countries like Chile, America and even France have been removing wine grapevines due to the global glut. I asked Sandy Hathaway, who's a senior analyst working for Market Insights with Wine Australia, if Australia is following suit and also reducing production.
No, pretty well no. you know, it's a difficult one because it's a lagging indicator, you know, and over the years we've had times before that have been tough and then good times have returned, and I can understand that growers would want to wait for good times to return again. You can perhaps not produce a crop in a given year or, you know, drop your crop on the ground and then sort of wait, you know, and it's not easy to remove vines. It's expensive and you've got to have something else to do with the land and something else to do yourself. Growing grapes is quite a nice thing to do and relatively easy compared with a lot of other crops and rewarding because it's just a really nice regional artisan industry overall. So there hasn't been a lot of adjustment as yet. But crunch time probably is coming. It's really the problem is, as I said, whether growers have alternatives and whether they can afford the costs of removal. If they simply leave their crops, the problem is what happens is that even though the wineries may want less or may not want as many grapes, the available supply is still all out there. So they don't have to increase their price because supply hasn't actually tightened up. Because if one grower says, well, I'd like more for my grapes, they can simply turn to the next grower and say, well, you weren't planning to grow a crop this year, but how about you do? So unfortunately, when we're not getting actual reductions in supply, we're just
continuing to have great prices sit very, very low.
I'm speaking to Sandy Hathaway today on The Country Hour. She's a senior analyst working with Wine Australia. Sandy, can we talk a bit particularly about white wine? Because a lot of the coverage on oversupply in recent years, we've certainly focused a lot on the glut of red wine and people making the switch perhaps from reds to whites as something of a solution. But what trends are you seeing with white wine?
Yeah, it's a bit sad, actually. What happened with white recently was in 2022 and 2023, globally, there were small harvests, particularly of white. And Chile, South Africa, New Zealand all ran out of white. And Australia as well. We had a pretty small harvest in 2023. So demand really tightened up for white. And this was just at the point where consumers were starting to turn their attention to whites and express more of a preference for whites. And this is small. This doesn't mean, you know, you go from 80% red to 80% white. You go from 55% red to 55% white. You know, it's just a really subtle shift in the middle. But nonetheless, those things combined to make demand for white much stronger. And then prices were stronger and prices in Australia were stronger. But then almost immediately that turned around. So New Zealand had a really big crop. In fact, they had a really big crop in 2022 and 23. But by the time that came on stream, you know, it was a bit later. And so then by the time, you know, like last year, we crushed in the inland regions, the Sauvignon Blanc crush was 40% above average. I mean, that's huge. And so it's really what you might call an overcorrection. And white wine is a lot more sensitive. It moves more quickly because you don't tend to keep it in stock for as longer. You don't tend to have as high a stock to sales ratio, which means you don't sort of hold as much stock relative to your sales, but also you've got to keep turning the white wine over more quickly. It doesn't go into barrels, that sort of thing. It's often wanted in the current vintage, you know, fresh. Wine is also used for other products much more, like concentrate, sparkling wine, and then your mixed products like your spritzers. So you can do more different things with white, and it's a more volatile in terms of the trends. And so what's happened now, and I don't think we've seen the worst of it yet, but because of that big crush in 2025 and the sort of drop in demand, and then, of course, the other thing, these sudden things that happen with the tariffs in the US very suddenly earlier this year, and then that's reduced demand for particularly New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, which was one of their big wine categories that, you know, they're most popular. So now that's put a lot more New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc on the market, and that tends to outcompete us for reasons I cannot understand. But it's good stuff. But anyway, so now we're really going to see that for this upcoming vintage, the wineries are unlikely to want large quantities of whites, particularly Sauvignon Blanc. I think Chardonnay is tracking along fairly well because that was hit quite hard in the 25 vintage with frost and that sort of thing. So I don't think there's an oversupply of Chardonnay, but it looks like there's too much Sauvignon Blanc, which, as you say, it's really kind of heartbreaking when a lot of growers were switching over to that a few years ago because that's what looked like was going to be the big demand. And so you can understand why growers are hesitant to follow the trends because there's such a long lag, really, in what you can do with a standing crop like a grapevine. And by the time, you know, you've grown the crop and then harvested it and then it's turned into wine, you're sort of 12 months, you know, from when you first made that decision.
And goodness knows what's happened in that meantime. As you say, there's so many factors that can, have that impact.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like the fundamentals for white are a bit better because it is used for more of the in fashion products. You know, more sparkling wine is the only wine category that's growing globally at the moment. And obviously a lot more sparkling is white than red. And a lot of the, you know, the limoncellos and other sort of spritz type products tend to have white as a base. But one thing that's happening there is we have noticed that more red wine, even Shiraz, is being
used put into white wine, because you can do that. If you crush the grapes without their skins, you can effectively turn what looks like a red grape into a white wine. And it's not happening a lot, and it would only be in pretty neutral products. But nonetheless, that's sort of adding to the amount of white wine because of the pressure from the oversupply of red wine.
Yeah. Well, you sort of, I guess, you know, look at one solution, it creates perhaps another bottleneck somewhere. It is a wicked problem where there might be ways that you think you can pivot, but if everyone's sort of pivoting in the same direction, it then sort of creates another problem to solve.
Yeah, that's exactly right, yes. And we do tend to overshoot, and I think we all know that. You know, it's a pendulum, isn't it? You can't get it exactly right. And I would say we've, in the short term at least, probably overcorrected on whites. But the other thing was, we were saying all along that in Australia there wasn't really a shortfall in whites. We were warning against, you know, well, let's put it this way, the information was not suggesting that we needed to go and plant a whole bunch of white. It was really, as you've just said, it was a response to a problem with red, that white was probably better than keeping going with the red. But we weren't short of white. Demand for white's been pretty flat overall. And apart from these little supply shocks with the big drop in 23 and now the big increase from 25. But apart from that, I think demand's remained pretty steady. And the prices for white grapes have been much more steady. And they're still a lot better than, you know, than they were for years and years. So if you're getting around $400 a ton in the inland regions of Australia for white grapes, you know, that's pretty reasonable. That's a lot better than where reds are at the moment. But what we've got to be very careful of is, yeah, chasing that and going, well, all right, if that's good, then more's got to be better. And more is definitely not better.
Sandy Hathaway there, a senior analyst working with Wine Australia. You're with Selena Green on the Country Hour on this Friday. Right now, it is 9 minutes to one.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, as we've reported previously, a new heavy vehicle barge is up and operating now at Cooper Creek to help reconnect producers in nearby communities that were cut off by flooding. Now, that barge will allow safe crossing until permanent road access is possible, helping move livestock and essential goods. Well, this week, the Landline program will take a look at how that's all been going. Well, Brooke Neindorf caught up with Landline reporter Kath Sullivan to find more about the upcoming story.
The fact that you're reporting on an almost $30 million boat that's come from the west coast of Australia to the outback is pretty unusual in itself, but there were a few more twists and turns than we had anticipated, that's for sure.
We might hear about them very shortly, but tell us first about the new outback boat.
Yeah, well, people who are living in the north of South Australia might have already heard about this barge named Margaret. It's what's called a jack-up barge, and it had been working out of Karratha in Western Australia. But when the Cooper Creek flooded earlier this year, cutting the Birdsville track, a plan was hatched with support from the state and federal governments to bring this barge to the outback so that it could ferry cattle trucks, road trains, across the flooded Cooper Creek, allowing the Birdsville track to remain open and servicing those who live north of where the creek flooded.
What's been the response from locals up there for it arriving?
Well, as you know, Brooke, there's not a lot of locals. This is a part of the world where not many people live, but a lot of cattle do. And this was something that really struck me. You know, we know about this part of the world, Central Australia, for its deserts. We know that it turns off a lot of cattle, but the South Australian government was expecting 50,000 cattle to come down off the Birdsville track to its abattoirs in the southern part of the state. You'll know TFI at Murray Bridge and Tees at Narra Court are major employers. And I think that was really part of the reason that they've stumped up half the cash, $27.4 million from the state and federal government to bring this barge. Not only the barge, they've had to pay construction workers to come into the area. And we're talking about people who work in saltwater construction coming to work with freshwater for a change. It's certainly been novel for a lot of the workers. There's had to be more than 45 kilometres of road rebuilt, a little detour off the track. That's because the best place for the barge was deemed to be a little bit east of the Birdsville track, where the Cooper Creek narrowed slightly and it was certainly deep enough. A lot of people are wondering how deep the Cooper Creek flood is to, in fact, support a barge or to have such infrastructure come in place. At last glance, the Department of Infrastructure and Transport in South Australia told me it was about 3.6 metres where this barge has been set up. I talked about the workers. There were cranes that have had to come from southern. It's been a really fascinating look at a national effort to support the pastoral industry, as well as the tourism industry too. And those few people, I think one of the people I spoke to for this story suggested it might be fewer than 100 people live on the Birdsville track. But now they know that their groceries will get to them a little bit quicker than what they had been without the barge.
And you spoke to a lot of people that have been using the barge. What's the experience like of putting a truck onto a barge like this one?
Oh, it's so funny, Brooke. One of the first things that somebody said to me was that they thought it would sink and was surprised that it hadn't. It's an amazing piece of infrastructure. It's supporting these huge road trains supported with cattle, but also other freight. One of the truck drivers we met using the barge was a fellow called Wade, who delivers groceries to those people living on the track. In fact, he was carrying one of the most important bits of freight, the beer, up to some of the stations when we spoke to him. But have a listen to how he used to, or formerly would get to those stations before the barge got there.
What sort of weight have you got that you're carrying up the track?
Today we're a bit light on, so we've probably got 15 tonne in the front one and maybe 15 in the back one of just all different products. There's steel and groceries and tyres.
How far are you travelling on this run?
This is about 1160 k's, I think it is, from Adelaide up to Birdsville, the direct route.
It is direct now thanks to the barge. Have you had a go?
Yes, I have. I've been on the barge once and that was a fortnight ago.
And how was it?
It wasn't too half bad. You don't even know you were moving on it. It's going that steady.
So. A bit unusual to be on a boat in the desert.
It is a little bit, yes, but it's mind-boggling seeing the water out here.
And what did you do when you couldn't go up the track?
We had to go up through Broken Hill to Tipperborough, from there up through to Nacundra across to Windora, and then into the back way of Birdsville. I think we worked it out about 560 k's longer, so it was 1,120 kilometres extra on the trip.
And how did you find the track? Would you rather be delivering groceries in Adelaide or up the Birdsville track?
No, I'd rather do it around here. Adelaide, me working in local in Adelaide, things don't mix.
That was Wade, a truck driver that was has been using the barge up there, Kath, and it sounds like it is going pretty well at the moment, and I imagine pastoralists are pretty happy that they can now move their cattle once again.
Yeah, look, I think there's been a few frustrations with putting this piece of infrastructure in on the Birdsville track. But all in all, the people that are using it and relying on it seem to be pretty happy with it. It's come a little bit later in the season than what they'd hoped. And, of course, anyone with an eye to the temperature lately will see that it is climbing. And there has been this pressure to try and get the cattle south before it gets too hot for the cattle, too hot for the people. And while they're in such good condition and really market ready. So responding to that, I guess, has been the South Australian government, which is operating the barge. And it's actually going 24/7. I think up until about the 5th of December, it's going around the clock to sort of try and help move that backlog of cattle who sort of, well, at least the pastoralists had hoped they'd be moved a little bit earlier this year than what's been the result.
That is Landline reporter Kath Sullivan there speaking to Brooke Neindorf. So make sure you tune into Landline this Sunday to see that story. You can catch up online at ABC iView as well as the Cooper Creek ferry story. I believe there's also a story on Landline this weekend about the sterile fruit fly facility at Kangaroo Island and the fantastic work being done there too. But on this story that Kath Sullivan has done on the barge, if you head to the Landline website right now, if you just search for ABC Landline, there's actually a story up there right now. You can read about their adventure and just the logistics of getting there to film the story with all of their gear. Apparently they got stranded on the side of the Birdsville track after their four-wheel drive broke down, and the locals had to come to the rescue. So it's a great read. Go and have a look at it right now if you just search for ABC Landline. That's pretty much it for me for today and for all this week on The Country Hour. You can catch up on anything you've missed on the ABC Listen app, or you can search for our website. Just search for South Australian Country Hour, and all of our episodes are on there. Next week is a big week for us. It is the 80th birthday of The Country Hour, nationally Australia's longest running radio programs, one of the longest running continuous radio programs in the world, in fact. We've got a lot planned, a big celebration, and we'll be very keen. We'll be putting out the call out for your birthday messages and maybe your memories of The Country Hour over the years. So yeah, really exciting week coming up next week. Catch you then. In the meantime, it's coming up to 1 o'clock. It's time for the news.
ABC Local Radio. We're live, local, and ad-free wherever you are. Download the ABC Listen app and listen now.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.